seated, everyone. We'll call our next case, which is case number 60065, Brown versus our state warden. We have Mr. Norwood representing the appellant, Mr. McCarthy representing the respondent. Before we proceed, late Friday we received a motion for leave to file a response to the supplemental authority under NRAP 31. This court can allow the filing of a response. However, the court has not had a chance to conference on that, so we'll take that request under submission this time, and we'll deal with that in conjunction with our disposition. Okay. You, counsel, are you ready to proceed?
May it please the court. My name is Ryan Norwood. I represent Christopher Brown. If I could, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time.
Yes, you may. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. From the beginning of Nevada's statutory procedure, post-conviction procedures in 1967, up until the present day, Nevada has consistently based its state good cause exception on the federal good cause exception that controls in federal court. In asking the court today to adopt the logic and reasoning of Martinez versus Ryan, all I'm asking is that the court continue this consistent practice of adopting the Supreme Court's evolving jurisprudence on federal good cause for purposes of defining state good cause. I would ask that the court reverse and remand this case so that the lower court can determine in the first instance whether or not Mr. Brown's post-conviction counsel was ineffective for not raising the issues that weren't raised in the petition in the initial post-conviction proceedings. Before 1967, there was essentially no procedure at all to raise constitutional claims in state court. What was happening was that petitioners were going directly to federal court, and everyone recognized that presented a problem. The solution to this problem was to create a comprehensive state post-conviction procedure whereby petitioners could raise their constitutional claims in state court before they came to federal court. The original laws in 1967 and 1973 were supported by and drafted by the Washoe County District's Attorney's Office. The intent of the legislature was to eliminate this gap between state review and federal review, to ensure that before petitioners came to federal court with their constitutional claims, those claims would be reviewed in state court first. Originally, this was a matter of comedy towards the federal courts, so that they wouldn't be burdened with deciding all of these claims in the first instance. But as federal law has developed, there have been other benefits to that approach that have arisen. One is the federal procedural default doctrine. In setting up a comprehensive system for review of post-conviction claims, the legislature has established rules. For example, the statute of limitations, the successive petition bar, and so forth. If a petitioner doesn't comply with those rules, the court doesn't hear the claims and the merits, and if he goes to federal court, the federal court will generally respect that state procedural default. Another benefit arose much later as a result of the passage of the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act in 1996. That is, when a state court does review a claim on the merits, and then that claim is rejected and it comes to federal court, the federal courts will generally have to defer to that state court decision. Only in a very narrow set of circumstances can the federal court come in and essentially overrule what the state court did. So from the very beginning, the purpose was to create this system whereby claims would be heard in state court before they came to federal court. The initial standards that were created in these laws were based directly on the then-controlling Supreme Court precedent. And as Supreme Court precedent has evolved, this court has made sure that the good cause exceptions in state law track those in federal law. The reason the good cause exception is important is even if a claim is defaulted in state court based on an adequate procedural rule and it comes to federal court, the federal court can still get around that default by finding what federal courts have defined as good cause and prejudice. In other words, which is a matter defined by federal law. So there's still this possibility for a gap. The way that Nevada has got around that possibility is they've created a state exception for good cause that is modeled exactly on the federal exception for good cause. So in essence, what the state is doing is looking forward to what might happen in federal court and conducting the same good cause inquiry in the first instance when the case is on state review. The federal case that first set forth the parameters of good cause in detail was Murray v. Carrier, which was decided in 1986. Since then, this court has cited Murray v. Carrier 41 times in various opinions and orders. Almost every important decision that this court has issued on the subject of state good cause cites back to Murray v. Carrier, from Passanisi, Mazin, Crump, Harris, Pellegrini, Hathaway, Bayerano, Mitchell, up to Hubler just last year. This court has based the state good cause standard on good cause as it was defined in Murray v. Carrier. As the Supreme Court standards have continued to evolve, this court has followed suit. So, for example, when the federal courts adopted the rule in Coleman v. Thompson, this court, overruling some of its prior precedent, followed Coleman v. Thompson in McCabe. When the federal courts made clear that actual innocence was an exception to otherwise defaulted claims, this court followed suit and adopted part and parcel the federal actual innocence standard that was set forward in Schlupp. The Martinez v. Ryan case is simply the latest evolution of federal law. Martinez addressed a question, it didn't overrule anything, it addressed a question that had been left open in the Coleman case and also by this court in McCaig. Coleman and McCaig generally held that the ineffective assistance from post-conviction counsel on a post-conviction appeal couldn't be a basis for cause. But it left open the question of whether the ineffective assistance of that counsel in the initial review proceedings, in the trial court level, failing to raise a claim there, could be cause. The reason this is important is because Martinez concerns ineffective assistance of counsel claims. Ineffective assistance, the right to effective assistance of counsel is probably the most important right that's guaranteed to a criminal defendant by the U.S. Constitution. Because without that right, there's no way to vindicate any of your other rights. You need to have an effective lawyer who can spot and raise issues and conduct your trial for you. The problem that Martinez recognized is that in many states, including Nevada, it's effectively impossible to raise issues of effective assistance of counsel on direct appeal. The only way that they can be effectively raised is in a collateral post-conviction proceeding, where an incarcerated prisoner may not have access to counsel and where they're going to have to do the investigation and the research on their own to raise these grounds, making it effectively impossible for many claims to adequately litigate these issues. What the Supreme Court was asked to do to solve this problem, Martinez, was to recognize a right to the effective assistance of counsel in collateral proceedings. Now, Martinez didn't go that far, but what it did do was recognize an exception to the default rule, under the good cause rule. What Martinez says is that if your post-conviction counsel in the initial review proceeding didn't raise a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel because of his or her ineffectiveness, that can be cause to have that claim heard in federal court. Now, while this didn't involve overruling any case in federal court, the Martinez exception, was contrary to the way that many courts had seen the issue before. Adopting Martinez here in Nevada, however, would be less of a big step here than it was in federal court, because here in Nevada we've already recognized the Martinez rule for over 15 years in capital cases where there is a statutory right to have the appointment of counsel. In those cases where counsel is appointed and that counsel is found to be ineffective in a subsequent proceeding, then the petitioner can essentially raise the Martinez claim as a means for having claims heard on their merits in the second proceeding.
Why wouldn't this be better left to the legislature as well? They could create a statutory exception.
What I'm asking the court to do here is in accord with what the legislature has wanted to do from the beginning, which is to ensure that there is going to be a state forum for these claims before they come to state court. From the beginning, the legislature intended that this good cause exception that we have would be based on federal law. You know, when the good cause exception, you know, at every point when the statute has been amended, 1967 and 1973 and 1985, the cause exceptions came directly from federal law. The good cause and prejudice exception, for example, that controls for successive petitions was taken directly from Supreme Court law at the time, setting forth good cause and prejudice from federal decisions. So the legislature has already made this decision that good cause and prejudice should be based on the federal standard, and this court has consistently followed that in interpreting the standard.
I guess where I'm struggling is if you don't have a constitutional right to post-conviction counsel, how can you argue effectively that you have a right to challenge ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, that was, I think that concern was why some people were surprised by Martinez. I mean, it was assumed, I think, before Martinez that it was sort of an all-or-nothing issue, whether you have the constitutional right or not. I mean, this court had already recognized sort of an exception to that in Crump v. Warden when it adopted the rule for capital cases. There's no constitutional right to have counsel appointed in any kind of post-conviction proceeding, but this court found that a cause exception could be based on the statutory right to the appointment of counsel. Martinez was sort of a compromise between what the petitioner had wanted, which was the constitutional right to counsel. It was based on a practical reality that whether there's a constitutional right to counsel or not, it's simply not fair to expect petitioners who don't have the benefit of competent counsel to raise claims, raise these complicated types of ineffective assistance of counsel claims, which depend upon research, independent investigation, to raise those claims without independent counsel. So Martinez says, well, we're not going to say you have a right to counsel, but if you don't have effective counsel, we'll let you argue that is a basis for good cause for getting around the procedural bar. What the state is asking the court to do today is something completely unprecedented. They're asking the court to rule for the first time in its history to explicitly reject a federal standard for good cause. The effect of that is going to be that petitioners like Mr. Brown are going to be able to go to federal court without having any review of their state claims. The federal courts are bound to apply Martinez. So if Mr. Brown can establish that his post-conviction counsel is ineffective there. If he does that, then the federal court is going to decide the claim on its merits in the first instance without having to give any deference to what the state court has done. This is exactly the result that this court and the legislature have sought to avoid from the very beginning by providing a state forum for these claims before they come to federal court.
How does Brown get around the procedural bars, though? Walk me through that. In other words, actual innocence, it's one thing to see actual innocence in a death penalty case because if the aggravators are illegal or invalid, we can always say that he couldn't have been convicted, couldn't have received the death penalty. But how do we do it in these type cases?
Actual
innocence or good cause. Tell me, even under the federal standard, what's the good cause in Brown?
The good cause would be the alleged ineffectiveness of the post-conviction counsel. Mr. Brown has a number of claims, many of them concerning the jury instructions that were given at his trial, which weren't raised by his trial counsel and weren't raised on his appeal. Mr. Brown's contention is that a competent post-conviction attorney would have raised these ineffectiveness claims when she had the opportunity to do so in the initial review proceedings, and she didn't.
Well, this is important because we have to tell our district judges exactly when to appoint counsel in post-conviction relief in the district court as opposed to, and when to appoint counsel for the appeal of the denial of post-conviction relief. It's very complicated, very confluent. And I understand what Justice Perger is saying. If you don't have a right at all to counsel, what's the difference if it's ineffective or not?
Well, first of all, I see that I'm digging into my last 2 minutes, but I will answer your question as best as I can. The principle is that if we're going to appoint people counsel, that we expect that the counsel will meet the Strickland standard. You know, that the lawyers are supposed to represent people effectively. They're not supposed to make unprofessional errors. I want to emphasize here that I'm not asking, I'm not saying that the way the court has to resolve the Martinez issue is to appoint counsel in every case. But in those cases where there is a claim made that meritorious claims weren't raised because the post-conviction counsel was ineffective, what the court should do is undertake an inquiry into that to determine whether or not the post-conviction counsel was effective or not. And that would be very similar to the inquiry that courts already do, again, in capital cases with post-conviction counsel, and also in any case where there's an allegation of ineffective assistance of counsel. So if a hearing were necessary, we would ask the attorney, you know, what the basis was for raising or not raising a certain claim. And then the court would determine, you know, whether that attorney's failure to raise the claim is ineffective assistance.
Okay. Mr. Nora, what we'll do is you have about 22 seconds. We'll round it off at 2 minutes. Court did have some questions for you, and we'll give Mr. McCarthy an additional minute 30. So you have 16 minutes and 30 seconds. So.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. You know I don't always use all my time anyway. I'm Terry McCarthy, Deputy District Attorney from Washoe County on behalf of the state. Let me begin by saying this. No matter what else happens, Christopher Brown doesn't get relief from this court. No matter what rule is announced or not is not announced, it has no application to him for two reasons. One of them is his claim of ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel is generic, not specific. And two, every court that has considered it has said that Martinez versus Ryan is not retroactive for the very simple reason is that it's not a new rule of constitutional law at all. It is a new equitable rule. Therefore, Christopher Brown gets no relief. However, this court invited the response, and I'm glad for the opportunity, so let's talk about it. Martinez versus Ryan is right about this much. States are going to have to choose how to respond to it. As you may guess, that choice has to be made by the legislature for a few different reasons. One of them is that it's not a constitutional rule. That is, Martinez versus Ryan, they called it an equitable exception, not a constitutional rule. But we have a statute. We have a statute that says the appointment of counsel is discretionary. That's been construed to mean just that. It is discretionary. It is not mandatory. If you say that there is an exception to the general rule, an equitable tolling or an equitable exception based on the ineffective assistance of counsel, of post-conviction counsel, then you are saying we overrule that statute. It is now mandatory, and it is mandatory in every case. Furthermore, every court must appoint a counsel sua sponte for every prisoner before they seek relief. Because you know what the next guy is going to be? The next guy is going to be the one who was late. He was beyond the one-year time limit allowed by the legislature. And when I file my motion to dismiss, he's going to respond and say, I didn't have a lawyer to advise me on whether to seek counsel. Not that I didn't have an effective lawyer. I had no lawyer at all. If that is the argument, and there is an equitable exception for the lack of counsel or the ineffective counsel to excuse a procedural bar, the district courts will have no choice but to grant that untimely petition and allow further inquiry in every case. There was a mention a few minutes ago about the intent of the legislature. If you can find that intent, to have no procedural bars at all, to have no issue of timeliness, to allow every prisoner at least two bites of the apple, you're doing better than I can. I can find no such intent of the legislature. The only policy, the only intent that this court has mentioned in the prior cases is to give respect to society's interest in the finality of judgments. If you open this floodgate now, you are acting quite contrary to society's interest in the finality of judgments. There are lots of other reasons why the legislature should do this, not this court. There's practical questions that have to be raised. Who's going to pay for it? I don't know. Are we to say that that this all comes out of the state public defender's budget as it does now? Well, I don't know. Legislature hasn't asked me that. I suspect they haven't asked this court either. But you're going to be ordering somebody to pay for it. Maybe each county should pay for it separately. Then there's a question of who should decide it. We may end up with the state intermediate court one day. And maybe it will fall within that court to decide.
Please don't use the word intermediate.
Pardon me?
Please don't use the word intermediate.
Intermediate, okay. Yeah. And there's more. I would point out that we're talking about following the Supreme Court as they interpret a federal statute that we don't have. Now, Congress may one day go back to work, possibly even in my lifetime, and they may overturn this new rule. Since it's not constitutionally based, they can do that. It's another reason, I think, to leave this to the legislature instead of to this court. The ultimate decision that the state will face, either in this court or in the legislature, is this. And I think Mr. Norwood got it right. Do we allow more extensive federal review, less deference, or do we increase the burden on the taxpayers of the state? That is the quintessential legislative decision. It should be made by the political branch, not by the judicial branch. There's different ways to go. Now, I think that the amicus brief written by Owens, the DA's Association, has a nice synopsis of quite a few cases that have said, no, don't expand this into state courts for just those reasons. And it's well written, and there's no need for me to expand it. I think it's clear that it has to be a legislative decision because it is not a new constitutional rule. The timeliness aspect of it, I got to admit that didn't come to me until quite recently. I don't see how there's a way around appointing counsel for every prisoner, sua sponte, before that 1 year is up. If this court were to follow the rule of Martinez versus Ryan, it would seem to me that it would create a duty on the district court to appoint post-conviction counsel for every prisoner on the day that prisoner is convicted. That may be a burden on the taxpayers of the state, but I think it's a legislative decision to make that decision. The policy that ought to be followed here is not the policy of increasing review. It ought to be the policy of respecting society's interest in the finality of judgments. And so the court ought not to do anything. If you were to create this equitable rule, as suggested in Martinez, the effect would be, in essence, to rule that at least two statutes are negated. They must be ignored, and that is 34.750 and 34.726 are just negated. 750 requires that the court consider various factors before appointing counsel. Well, you're going to have to say no. You don't have to consider that. You must appoint counsel, and you must do it in every case. The other one is the statute of limitations is gone. If the effect is to essentially overrule two different statutes, I don't think it's a viable argument to argue that the legislature intended that. I don't think they intended for this court to overrule them. Now, if, nonetheless, the court is convinced that there ought to be something, I do have a suggestion. And that is, there's three federal cases, three U.S. Supreme Court cases that arose in the last few years. It's Maple versus Thomas, Martinez versus Ryan, and then the more recent Texas case, Trevino. In each case, there is no claim at all presented. That is, no court ever got to review any aspect of the performance of trial counsel. And in Martinez, the court made it very clear, that's what their concern is, that there was nothing, that there was no review at all. So if you're insistent on doing something, I think that's what you have to do. I think that once there is a review, that equitable exception no longer applies. In each case, there was nothing, no review at all. In Maples, the two lawyers abandoned their client. They resigned from their law firm and went on their way. Never told their client they were quitting, never told the court they were quitting, never did anything. And likewise, in Trevino, there's no review because, like in Nevada, there's no practical way to raise a claim of ineffective assistance on direct appeal.
Even under that suggestion, Mr. McCarthy, isn't it the case that counsel would have to be appointed in every criminal case
where
you have disparate treatment among defendants who have appointed counsel and those who didn't get counsel appointed?
I think it is absolutely clear, at least in my view, if you create any variation on this equitable rule announced in Martinez, that yes, every prisoner gets a lawyer.
But we do that
now.
Well,
we do it twice.
The DJs do that now. Sometimes they appoint counsel, sometimes they don't. And a lot of times they don't have a hearing.
If you follow the Martinez versus Ryan rule, that will no longer be true. We will ignore the statute, and you will have to appoint counsel for every prisoner, even without a request. I don't think you'd have to wait for a request. I think the obligation would arise on the moment they were convicted to advise them on whether they should seek post-conviction relief or not. And I recommend against that. To further think, we probably have to open the gates to the prison and let everybody out who's already in there because they didn't have counsel. But right now, courts often appoint counsel once they get a petition. Of course, I think that if you follow this rule, that courts will have to appoint counsel before there is even a petition. But it doesn't happen all the time. Now, the courts have discretion. They are to consider various factors. And there is no way. It's prohibited by statute to appoint counsel before there is a petition.
Mr. McCarthy, how do you respond to counsel's argument that the legislature and or this court have repeatedly recognized good cause exceptions adopted by the federal courts since those statutes were enacted, and why shouldn't we do so in this case?
A couple of reasons. One of them is, I'm not sure all those prior decisions were correct. And two, I learned quite some time ago that we've always done it that way is not a valid argument. And I don't think we have always done it that way either. But there has been a great deal of correlation. But the statutes being construed are not the same. I saw this once before where a state court of last resort said, this is a matter of discerning the legislative intent. And then they said, we construe the legislative intent to be whatever it was. And then cited a decision of a Wyoming court in support of the proposition that the Nevada legislature intended this result. That's not the correct approach. Now, more importantly, the Nevada Supreme Court's construction of state law is a matter of state law. The U.S. Supreme Court's construction of the federal statute in discerning the intent of Congress has no bearing at all on discerning the intent of the Nevada legislature. So although we have, in fact, followed some, not all, U.S. Supreme Court cases about cause, I'm wondering if some of those were right, and just because we've done it before doesn't mean we should keep doing it. If we did, we would be invalidating a number of statutes. It would have no effect anymore. If there is anything we can conclude about the intent of the legislature in Nevada, it is that the legislature did not intend to be emasculated. They intended to have some effect. And if we take away their statutes and say this business about evaluating these factors when determining whether to appoint counsel, that means nothing anymore, I don't think we can honestly say that follows the intent of the Nevada legislature.
Reasonable people read the Martinez case in different ways, I think. But it seems to me, from my reading, that the underpinning of the rule was a concern by the Supreme Court that there's a deprivation of review of effective assistance of counsel on direct appeal. Should this court consider a good cause exception to the first petition?
I'm not sure I follow. Regarding effective assistance of appellate counsel?
The effective assistance of either appellate counsel or trial counsel.
No, I don't.
Whether first year is blown.
I don't think so. I think that our legislative scheme, our statutory scheme, provides the only mechanism we have for evaluating the performance of trial counsel and direct appeal counsel. And I certainly wouldn't go any further than that. So
the structure we currently have statutorily, in your view, allows for a remedy of challenging effective assistance of trial counsel and appellate counsel.
Absolutely. We do it every day. Keeps me employed. So this court has said before that may I finish this thought?
Yes, go ahead.
The remedy exists as a matter of legislative grace. The U.S. Supreme Court has recognized that states need not provide post-conviction relief at all. If they do, they can't erect irrational barriers, that is, filing fees and things like that. If it is true that our legislature could repeal all those statutes in Chapter 34, then that should be the legislative decision. This court ought not to say that not only is this can't be repealed, but we're going to expand on it and create the right to effective assistance in this. Okay, now I'm out of time, and I thank you for your full
attention. Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. Mr. Norwood.
Mr. McCarthy is vastly overstating what Martinez says. Martinez does not say that a court is obligated to appoint counsel in every case, and it does not lead inevitably to that result. I agree that in many cases it
would. But how do you deal with the disparate treatment of defendants who get counsel from some district court judges for post-conviction review and those who do not? Aren't we going to face that question pretty soon? Isn't the defendant who didn't get counsel going to make the argument to the court that I wasn't appointed counsel? I wanted to raise ineffective assistance claims. In fact, as I understand your argument, one of the issues here is the fact that people aren't able to address effective assistance of trial or appellate counsel.
The first thing I say is that the issue of disparate treatment exists right now. You know, as it is in cases, you know, especially from the 8th Judicial District, it's very rare for the district court to appoint counsel. In other jurisdictions, especially the 2nd JD, it's quite common. Mr. Brown was appointed counsel there. So this issue already exists. Martinez is actually a way of addressing that disparate treatment by ensuring that everybody will have the same opportunity. If you get competent counsel appointed to represent you on your first post-conviction petition, then you won't have a Martinez claim. But if you don't, all Martinez says is that you have this narrow exception for good cause that you can present in a second petition. This doesn't mean that in every single one of those second petitions that there's going to be a new opportunity to have new claims heard on their merits. It doesn't even mean that the court needs to hold a hearing in every single one of these cases to determine if counsel is ineffective. If this seems to be an underlying concern by the state that the petitioners are going to use this as a means to raise new frivolous claims in a second petition, the easiest way to resolve that is to simply say that those claims don't have merit. So
does the rule on Martinez have prospective or retroactive effect?
It has. No court, Mr. McCarthy is flatly incorrect when he says that no court has ever held that it has a retroactive effect. As was pointed out, it's not a constitutional rule. It's just a rule of federal, of good cause. And those rules apply retroactively as well as prospectively.
Would our rule apply prospectively or retroactively were we to adopt it?
The rule should apply, insofar as it would apply to Mr. Brown, it should apply to every petitioner who is coming in on a second petition raising the Martinez good cause exception. This court has always viewed its rules of good cause as applying immediately. So when a court adopts good cause frameworks in cases like Madison and McCaig, those rules have always been understood to apply here on out to everyone.
What do we do with the third, fourth, and fifth petitions?
We don't need to answer that question right now. Martinez, on its terms, only applies to ineffective assistance in a first collateral proceeding. I can't predict everything that's going to happen down the road with Martinez, but the court doesn't need to go down that road right now. It only needs to adopt what Martinez clearly is saying.
But until Martinez came out, a lot of our people that are incarcerated never raised the issue. In other words, they didn't raise the Martinez issue that it was ineffective assistance of counsel. They raised a zillion other issues that we've seen. So they may be their first bite of the apple may be the fourth or fifth successive petition. Not successive because it's different issues.
I agree that there are a lot of different permutations of the issue, and I'm not asking the court to resolve every possible issue that could come up. And Mr. Brown, this is his second petition where he actually anticipated a Martinez argument because Martinez wasn't decided when the case was first litigated. So the court doesn't need to go any farther than to say that it would apply to Mr. Brown. And like any other case, we can figure out the additional permutations as we go along. It's the only way that we can do it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Norwood, and thank you both, as always, for your excellent arguments and briefs, and the case will stand submitted then.